So I've been talking about this chapter of Dogen's called Gakudo Yojinshu. Generally a chapter it's translated as Aspects of Zazen or Aspects of Meditation. So it's this chapter, it's a work with different sections, and its function is basically to encourage us or to give us some tips and pointers on how to support our practice and how to really bring attitudes that we can bring to practice and how to really bring practice into action into our daily life. I'm working on the section called The Necessity of Being Aware During Zazen, The Necessity of Being Mindful During Meditation. Actually, I should comment on that a little bit. There is a lot of talk these days about mindfulness practice in Buddhism and mindfulness meditation. And that is an excellent element of Zazen practice. It has a sort of technical meaning in Vipassana meditation or the Theravadan kind of Theravadan tradition of meditation, the South Asian Buddhist traditions, and is actually slightly different than what we do in Zazen or Zen practice. And in some sense, the word awareness is a broader term that fits better with the type of meditation that we're cultivating in Zen practice. Mindfulness has a connotation of being aware of minute details of actions and that we are doing physically and mental functioning that's going on. Awareness has a narrowing in kind of quality to it. The idea of mindfulness as a narrowing in quality. It focuses on individual and discrete functioning. Where I put my foot, how I hold my hands, all these things. And that's an important element of what we're trying to do. But the idea of awareness has a bit broader kind of connotation to it. So in other words, I'm aware of where I put my foot, but I'm also just aware of the whole context of putting my foot in the room where I am and the people that I'm with. So there's that quality too that we bring to meditation, and that is part of our meditation. One of the hallmarks of Soto Zen practice is the idea of sitting with our eyes open. Okay, when we get meditation instruction, we're encouraged to sit with our eyes open. And that, one of the functions of sitting with our eyes open is that we're grounded in the present reality of this particular body and mind, this particular moment, these particular conditions, this particular circumstance. And we sit with our eyes open in order to be aware of, to be grounded in the reality of this body and mind, the conditions that we have right here. And, of course, there's a profound significance to that, as well as a practical significance to that. The profound significance to that is that Buddha nature actually exists right here in these conditions, in these circumstances that we are living through right now. These ordinary, mundane circumstances is permeated with Buddha nature. And that is quite profound. And as we sit still in our meditation practice, we become aware of that. And there is also the practical matter of just the benefit of being aware of what's going on right in front of us, instead of being distracted by our mental functioning or our dreams about what we'd like things to be or our storylines and that sort of thing. So we bring ourselves back to this present moment. So that's sort of the context of this chapter, the necessity of being aware. Dogen has a great thing where he'll name a chapter, and then he'll be talking about something that's completely different than what the name implies until later on in the section. before I get in, before I start reading this, again, I mentioned earlier that sometimes with Dogen, it's important to remember that he is speaking to a particular audience at a particular time. He's speaking to, most often, an audience of monks training in the monastery where he's the abbot. And so he knows this group of people really well, and he knows the issues that they're kind of thinking about that are that's coming up in their training, and he's trying to address those issues in his Dharma talk. So a lot of times, work that we read, 750 years after the life of Dogen, is actually quite oriented and specifically targeted to a group of people who lived his time. And you have to kind of bear that in mind when you're reading what he's writing. He has a kind of, his work has a universal significance, which is important, and is, you know, profound and points to some profound things. But it also has a very local kind of perspective. And this this section is not different from that. So we have to read it with that in mind, and I'll read some here. So, Zazen being of grave importance, neither neglected nor regarded lightly. There have been magnificent examples of old masters in China who cut off their arms or fingers for the sake of the truth. Centuries ago, the Buddha forsook both his home and his country. To do so are sure signs of true training. People of the present time say that they need only practice what comes easily. This is very bad. Such thinking is not at all akin to true Buddhism. So he's kind of got a little, starting off with a little harangue here about the importance of really practicing hard and seriously. And there is an element of truth in that, that we, and as we talked about it earlier in our exploration of this chat, of this work, what we put into practice is what it is. What we get out of practice is relative to what we put into practice, and that is just something to bear in mind. I think that if I were to kind of point out an element of this that we could kind of let go of, it would be the element of stressing doing something that we are unable to do in our particular present situation, our particular present conditions. In other words, you know, Dogen can say, there have been masters in China who cut off their arms and fingers for the sake of the truth. Well, you know, I'm personally not able to cut off my arm or finger for the benefit of the Dharma, for the sake of the truth. It doesn't appear to me as a good idea to do that, and my teachers have all encouraged me not to do that. And so, while we can see it as a historical kind of and symbolic kind of means of expressing sincerity, I don't want to encourage anybody to do that, and to really understand that what we're trying to do is make the Dharma come alive in a particular present life and in a particular present time. We are where we are. We start where we start. And that has quite significant implications, as I was alluding to earlier. So bear his harangue lightly as we go through this. If you concentrate on only one thing and consider it to be training, then it is impossible to even lie down in peace. If one action is done with a bored or uneasy mind, all things become boring or uneasy. Now, this is a really important thing to consider about practice. In a sense, what we're doing in there's a way in which you can change your perspective about life relative to practice, in which practice comes to be the center of your life, and that doesn't mean necessarily that it actually takes up the most time. it just becomes, it just is a perspective that you take to the rest of your life. And so that means that when you're doing, like today with the kids, our practice was to cut out some bird silhouettes to tape to the window to try to get the cardinals to not peck on the window, and we took a minute and walked out to the pond and looked for some birds, and all this had really nothing to do with Buddhism. I mean, in a certain respect, they're doing it with a monk, and maybe some practices kind of rubbing off on them. But my thought is to be able to say, to be able to show that meditation, the precepts or practice, really is part of everything, can be part of everything that we do, depending on how we kind of take ourselves to it. Okay. And so what he is referring to here, concentrating on only one thing and consider that to be training, is the idea, for instance, there were monks who at various times who specialized in reciting one scripture. They memorized something like the Avatamsaka scripture. I say that quite glibly. You should know that the Avatamsaka scripture is like a couple thousand pages long, and is really quite ornate and very abstruse. So memorizing the Avatamsaka scripture is in itself quite an amazing feat. But it is not the practice that we're actually trying to undertake, and is not really Zazen practice. It is just the practice of memorizing something really long and abstruse. Okay, and if you think the practice is memorizing something, then you will have missed the point, and you will have missed the opportunity of learning how to do whatever you're doing with a still and peaceful mind. Okay. I know full well that they who seek things the easy way do not look for the true way. Shakyamuni was able to give the teaching at present to be found in the world after undergoing very difficult training, and thus he is the great teacher. He was the source. As this is so, how can the descendants of Shakyamuni gain anything by taking it easy? So we have to ask ourselves then, as we're kind of looking at this, well, what does he mean by that? What does that taking it easy mean? What is he really kind of getting at? Track my place, that'd be good. The mind that seeks the way does not search for easy training. Should you look for an easy means of training, you will probably not reach the true realization, and you can never find the treasure house. Okay, so I should mention again, the mind that seeks the way, this is something that he took up right at the beginning of this chapter. It is translated as, it is the translation of the term bodhicitta, or the mind, citta of enlightenment, bodhi. And that is the impulse to train, the impulse to find something deeper in our lives. Okay. He says bodhicitta, earlier on in this work, he says bodhicitta is equivalent with seeing through to impermanence, with seeing that impermanence exists in the world, that my life is impermanent, that all the things that I might pursue are impermanent. We have this sense, oh, things are impermanent, and that can be quite, in a sense, upsetting, because we think that things ought to be stable and reliable and permanent in a way that will make us satisfied. The mind that seeks the way is the mind that recognizes impermanence, that says, oh, these things are impermanent. There must be something more. There must be something deeper, some other place that I can put my energy and rely upon. Okay. The mind that seeks the way does not search for easy training. And so, in a way, what he's again pointing to with this easy quality, the easy thing would be something, again, that is permanent, that is stable, that is reliable. And that actually doesn't exist. In a sense, even though we might have the sense, oh, everything's impermanent, like for myself, you know, I started practicing many years ago and I thought, oh, great, everything's impermanent. Good, I can embrace that. And since that time, my practice has been a study, ongoing study, in discovering all the ways that I still don't think that everything is impermanent. And to train myself to accept that, and to understand and be at peace with that situation. Okay. Our minds want to have things be tidy and simple. We want resolution. And resolution happens, but it doesn't usually happen in the way that we want it to. And we have to recognize that there is a great impulse in us to try to get things to be permanent, even though on some level we recognize there isn't. And it is that thing, that impulse, which wants to get things to be impermanent, which is, I think, what he's pointing at about taking the easy way, finding a way which allows you to think, okay, now I've got the problem solved, I can just do X, Y, and Z, and everything will be fine. That's the easy way. And sometimes that easy way actually turns out to be quite difficult in a human sense, and we'll get into that a little bit here later on. But in terms of practice, in terms of what real practice is, it is much more difficult to just sit still and recognize that things are impermanent and accept that. The most excellent of the old ancestors said that training was hard to undergo, for Buddhism is deep and immense. The great masters would never have spoken of the difficulty of Buddhism had it been easy. There's a teacher, Theravadan teacher, named Ajahn Chah, who was is a famous meditation master in the last century, who is the teacher of a number of Theravada monks who are practicing in the United States now and all over the world. And he had this great saying. He said that there are two kinds of suffering in the world. There's the suffering of life, as we know it, and there's the suffering of training, the suffering of practicing Buddhism. You might think to yourself, wait a minute, I'm practicing Buddhism to get away from suffering. But he had a good insight there, and the idea is that if we undergo a practice, it will be difficult. There will be suffering involved in that. There will be difficulty involved in that. But that it will be less, that there will be less suffering as a result of practice than there would be simply by pursuing our mistaken view of how things ought to be. Okay. So he's trying to be realistic for us and say, well, yeah, suffering, practice is going to be difficult. It's hard to sit still in the midst of and let go of something that we really want to have, our desires, and not act on them, even though we recognize, you know, we really want something, we recognize if I go for that, it's going to be suffering. Or if we're angry, we need to be able to sit still within anger and say, you know, kind of say to ourselves, if I act out of this anger, if I give into this anger, there's going to be suffering, so I really need to sit still. And that sitting still and not acting out of these things is not an easy matter. That's a difficult thing to do. But we can all recognize that is a benefit, and will be a benefit to us and a benefit to those beings around us. Okay. The same is also true of delusion, that when we have misunderstanding arising in our minds, it can be quite difficult to just sit still and allow it to arise and pass away. You might not even recognize that it's there. Most of the difficulty with delusion is coming to actually accept that we might be deluded. Because delusion tells us, I'm right. I must be right. And my rightness is right. to sit still within that and allow for the possibility that we could be wrong is actually quite a difficult thing. By comparison with the old ancestors, people nowadays amount not even to so much as a single hare in a herd of 9 cows. Even if they do their best, pretending it is hard, they do not begin to attain the easy training. And understanding of the ancestors because of their lack of strength and knowledge. Let me reread that. Even if they do their best, pretending it is hard, they do not begin to attain the easy training and understanding of the ancestors because of their lack of strength and knowledge. What is taught as easy training and beloved by present-day man? It is neither secular nor Buddhist, for it cannot be compared to the teachings of devils and evil gods, nor can it be compared to heresy and the two vehicles. The delusions of ordinary people have deep roots, and they trap themselves in eternal transmigration by pretending to escape from the present world. So I see myself described there. I'd much rather kind of watch TV and get involved in a story than kind of deal with whatever it is that I'm dealing with or whatever. I have the capacity in my mind to invent a story and spend time elaborating that story rather than just being willing to sit still in the presence of, fixing the toilet or whatever. And it is quite understandable that we do that. We have that capacity. And it's not something that we need to feel as though we need to kind of completely get rid of. There's a great passage in the Lotus Sutra, one of the important sutras of our tradition of Mahayana Buddhism, that talks about the magic city. It's a chapter called The Magic City. So, and in The Magic City, this chapter of the Lotus Sutra, it describes a number of people who are on a very long and arduous journey through a desert. They've got a good leader. He's leading them in, kind of in the right direction. Everybody's kind of happy with that, but it's quite arduous and quite tiring. And so the good leader says to himself, my followers are getting tired. They're getting thirsty. They need a bath. They need to eat. So we will generate a magic city and we'll take a rest. So he creates with his magical powers a city that they can all stop in, take a rest, sit in the shade, get the right amount of food, do all those things, and take a break from the difficulty of their journey. And then, once they've rested, they get back on the road and head off through the desert again. It is a deeply compassionate element of our human being that we can, at times, take a rest, that we can, at times, spend a bit of time just relaxing and renewing ourselves. Okay. And we need to be able to remember that. But part of the thing about practice is learning how to be an adult with the reality of our situation. Recognize when it's useful to take a break, to spend a little time in the magic city, as it were, and when it's time to actually hit the road and do the work of training. So that's what he's talking about, pretending to escape from the present world where we, just kind of, things are just kind of ugly and I'd really rather not be here, so I'm going to go somewhere else. Well, that's not exactly what Zen practice is about. It is difficult to break the bones and crush the marrow from outside, and to control the mind is more difficult still. It is even of greater difficulty to undergo true training and long austerity, whilst the greatest difficulty of all is the harmonizing of the training of body and mind. Many in olden times underwent a training which required the crushing of their bones, and if this were valuable, they should have become enlightened, but only a handful did. So that's what I was talking about that. We have this idea of what hard training is, what the difficult way to do training is. And it usually involves some kind of austerity, some kind of asceticism, some kind of difficult practice in an external sense. Sometimes those things can be useful for a time. They can help us to develop our will and all that. But that's not really what hard training is about. They who endured austerity in like manner should have become enlightened, but here again, few did. This is because, when undergoing such training, it is extremely difficult to harmonize body and mind. Neither a clear head nor a good knowledge of learning are of great importance, and any more than our mind, will, consciousness, thought, understanding, or perception. All of them are useless. That's a very interesting thing. Mind, will, consciousness, thought, understanding, or perception, all are useless. They're useless because in the context that he's talking about, but let me just continue on. To enter the stream of Buddhism, one must just simply harmonize the mind and the body. Shakyamuni said that one must turn the stream of compassion within and give up both knowledge and its recognition. So this is a really important point. And it points to, again, the thing that is difficult, the thing that is not easy. But it also points to the thing which we can do, no matter who we are. Neither a clear head nor a good knowledge of learning are of great importance any more than our mind, will, consciousness, thought, understanding, or perception. It doesn't matter what kind of characteristic we have. It doesn't matter what kind of person we are. It doesn't matter at any given moment whether we have any particular skill at all. It doesn't matter. I mean, in a practical sense, all those things are nice. But in terms of training, in terms of harmonizing body and mind, they don't matter. What harmonizing body and mind means is being willing to let go of whatever it is that's arising in our minds and do what is good to do. To be able to let go of whatever is going on in our bodies and minds and to be one with Buddha nature. That is the difficult thing. We can sit still in whatever conditions are arising. Just sit still, let them go, arise, and pass away. And when we do that, we are, in a sense, one with Buddha nature. And that is the difficult thing. Now, there are profound implications with harmonizing body and mind. There are different layers and levels and all that stuff. But that's kind of the essential point right in there. Okay? Harmonizing ourselves with Buddha nature. Harmonizing ourselves with the mind that seeks the way, harmonizing ourselves with the eternal, if you want to call it that, with God, if you want to call it that. Okay. That is the hard thing. And it's hard because we're so invested in ourselves. We're so invested in our views, our opinions about how things ought to be. We're so invested in what I like, what I want, what I don't want, all those things. Fair enough. That's how where we are, that's the reality of what we're doing. And that's what our training is, to just continually let go of those things. Just continually offer them up, continually offer them to the Buddha. Herein lies the full meaning of the above. For in this, neither movement nor stillness are in the ascendancy, and this is true harmony. Just sit still, arise, things will arise. We don't have to fix them. We don't have to do anything with them. We don't have to think about them. We don't have to understand them. Just sit still. Things arise. They're there for as long as they want to be. They pass away. Continuous like. If one could penetrate Buddhism as the result of intelligence and learning, certainly Shinshu could have done so. I imagine Shinshu was a brilliant Chinese somebody or other. If it were difficult to penetrate Buddhism because of low birth and class, Daikon Enno could never have become the supreme ancestor. Daikon Enno was the sixth ancestor. He was the illegitimate son of a wood cutter, a firewood collector, and he happened to awaken to the truth in the marketplace, hearing someone talk about the Diamond Sutra. Okay. But there's a whole sutra written about him. Quite a good Zen master. The means by which Buddhism is transmitted is far beyond normal intelligence and understanding. Look carefully for all signs within yourself. Meditate upon yourself and train hard. It's far beyond normal intelligence and understanding, and yet it is right here in this present body and mind, in that present body and mind, 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 that present body and mind. In the body and mind of each one of us, it's present. It exists. The unborn exists. It's present here, and we can find it. We can know it. We can see it. We can experience it. It doesn't matter what our state of mind is. We can know it. Okay. The teachings of Zen make no choice between either old or young. Joshu did not begin to train until he was over 60, but he was a very fine ancestor. The priestess Teijo started her training at the age of 12 and became the finest of priests in her monastery. It is the amount of effort made that conditions the understanding of Buddhism received, and this differs according to the training or lack thereof. Again, there's that idea. You have to accept that. What we put into practice conditions what we get out of practice. It's pretty simple. They who have spent much time in worldly or scriptural study should visit a Zen training center. Many have already done so. Bodhidharma taught the clever Eshi, known as Nangaku, whilst Daikonano taught Yoka Genkaku. To make the truth clear and enter the way, one must study with a Zen master. One must never try to bring a Zen master's teaching down to one's own level of understanding. For, should one try to understand it from one's own self-opinionated viewpoint, one will never understand. Now, this is a really important point, and is also one that you have to really be careful about. It's not that a Zen master in a kind of absolute sense knows better than us, but they do have something that they have experience with and are trying to help us to come to understand. And as a point of practice for each one of us, it is really important that we come to understand, come to grips with, come to learn how to train our own relationship to our own opinions. Okay? So it's not that the Zen master is this great god, but that in the relationship between us and a Zen master, us and a teacher, us and a monk, it is, if there's an opportunity there for us to come to understand how we relate to our own opinions. Okay. This is profoundly important. And it is only by actually interacting with other people that we come to find out how we interact with our own opinions. Okay? If you're just kind of off doing your own thing, like in a cave or whatever, you're never going to kind of know what your opinions are, how you relate to your opinions. You know, like if I'm attached to having my oatmeal at 68 degrees in the morning, which is pretty cold, you just do that all the time, you wouldn't recognize that you were attached to that. But if someone comes along and says, well, I'm the Zen master here and we make the oatmeal my way, this happens, and then you realize you have to eat your oatmeal at 110 degrees, you might think, this is awful. My oatmeal was good the way I liked it before. Well, it was fine, it was good. But how are you clinging to your suffering, your view about how you ought to have oatmeal, okay? Are you able to let go of that idea? It's not that, again, ultimately, oatmeal should be one way or the other. It's how we relate to that, how we relate to our view of how the world ought to be, that we need to really come to grips with, we need to really understand.
Is that those, and I, maybe this is the next line, I don't remember. I think it's Dogen says, if ultimately what a Zen master or teacher says to you there's probably going to be some kind of conflict. If you find yourself always agreeing, then you're probably not... Does he say you're probably not with the right teacher? You're,
yes.
Oh, is that the next line? Or
it comes up here pretty quick.
Okay.
So. Yeah. Should the teaching you hear from a Zen master go against your own opinions, he is probably a good Zen master. If there is no clash of opinions in the beginning, it is bad.
Yeah, that one's always kind of troubled me. In light of what you just said, it makes a little bit better sense, but I'll be interested to hear more on that.
Well, it goes, again, right to that point, that it's not that we're trying to find the ultimately best opinion about how things ought to be. That's completely not the case in practice. What we're trying to understand is how we relate to our own opinions and how opinions are related to, okay? How I cling to my view of how the world ought to be, and whether or not I turn that clinging into suffering. And part of the job of a Zen teacher, and different Zen teachers will go about this in different ways, if someone comes to us and says, I'd like to learn about Zen, part of the job is to recognize that when someone wants to learn about Zen, what they're asking to do is learn about how they relate to their own views and opinions. And so, depending on the relationship, it will be their job to point out that. So they might actually say some pretty preposterous things as a means of kind of helping you to see where you are clinging to your opinions. Now, that's all a very difficult, it's a very difficult area of training, one that you need to be quite careful about, okay? And the more we can have that view about it, that, okay, here's my opportunity to look at my own, the way that I relate to my own opinions and views, the clearer it can all be. Because sometimes there are quite legitimate views on how things ought to be done. I remember, kind of struggling with this myself when I was training at Shasta and going to one of the people who I would take refuge in, one of the monks, one of the teachers, or Master Hario, as it turns out. And he kind of shrugged and said, well, it's just all opinions, really. Everything is just an opinion about how things ought. There isn't like an ultimate way of doing things. There isn't ultimate truth. And so it becomes incumbent upon us as Zen practitioners to just learn how to let that go. And that doesn't mean that we become wishy-washy kind of people who don't have views and who don't have a valuable input into how things ought to go. And there is where it becomes tricky. How do we be that person with valuable input? But how do we be that person without holding on to our views, our opinions? And in the beginning, there may well be a clash of opinions about how things ought to be. Or it might come about 10 years down the road. And we just have to be able to be willing to go through that. Not with, again, the view that we're going to find the right way to do things, but with the view, this will be helpful to me to find out something about myself. Does that make sense?
I mean, it helps with humility. I mean, or it helps, I guess, to see that and to... I say humility. I mean, that's what kind of comes to mind.
Yeah, humility in the sense of what practice is pointing at. That humility of just being willing to let go of whatever there is. It's the kind of reality of bringing meditation into our daily practice, into our daily life, our daily action of life. And there is a humble quality about meditation. We were just having this conversation at the conclave about our relationship to the head of the order. Okay, he's the most senior monk in our order, and if he asks for things to be done in a certain way, it is our training to say, okay, we'll do it that way because you asked it. And no matter what kind of realization that we've had, no matter how smart we are, how great a monk we are, it's just our training to say, okay, I'll do it the way you ask me to, because you're the head of the order. And there is a humility, a quality of humility in that. And there's also, to me, kind of more importantly, more fundamentally, more profoundly, there is a recognition that everything is impermanent. Everything can be part of meditation. Everything can be seen from the view of, can be lived from the view of the mind of meditation, which is just allow things to arise and pass away. Not holding on, not pushing away. Profoundly important. Everything falls into that. Everything is encompassed in that. Before asking for the truth from a master, you must make your body and mind pure and quiet in your perceptions, so that both eyes and ears perceive and hear in peace. Simply listen to the teaching and do not allow it to become soiled by your own thoughts. Your body and mind must be at one with each other, as water is poured from one bowl to another. If you can achieve such a state of body and mind, the truth that the master teaches can be made with one with yourself. And again, it just comes down to this. There is what is ideal and there is what is actual. This is the practice. This is where the practice happens. It's not that these things happen overnight or that we can kind of automatically generate them. It is by letting go of our opinions and views that we find this peace of mind. It is by letting go of our views and opinions that we allow our bodies and minds to quiet. Okay. At the present time, the unwise memorize the scriptures and cling to what they have heard. They try to equate such things with the master's teaching, but actually only rehear their own opinions of those and those of others, which do not at all equate with the teaching that they have received. They are convinced that their own opinions are right, and then memorize a few parts of the scriptures, calling this Buddhism. Should the teaching you hear from a Zen master go against your own opinions, he is probably a good Zen master. If there is no clash of opinions in the beginning, it is bad. People who are stuck with their own opinions frequently do not know how to get rid of them, and so cannot use the teaching given to them. For a long time they suffer from grave confusion and must be regarded with great grief. Presumption, discrimination, imagination, intellect, human understanding, and the like have nothing to do with Buddhism when studying Zen. Again, they're useful. They kind of come in handy and all that stuff. But in the essential matter of Zen practice, they're not that important. They're not the important thing. The important thing is this being willing to harmonize body and mind, being willing to let go of what there is, whatever there is, and just be still with it. And being willing to just continue to go through the process of learning what that actually is in actual life. Because we don't just become kind of vapid slugs who don't do anything, okay? If you meet people who have been practicing Zen for a while, they're actually quite active people and are doing all kinds of things and have all kinds of views and opinions, which they freely spout sometimes. There's a kind of deeper quality to it than that. There's a willingness to be still, to let go of things. Too many people are like children, playing with such things from birth. You must awaken to Buddhism right now. Above all, you must avoid presumption and choice. Reflect carefully upon this. Only the Zen masters know the gateway to the truth. Professors have no knowledge thereof. Avoid presumption and choice. Avoid it in the sense of look carefully when you see those things arise in your mind. What is really going on? What is really happening? My preconceived notions, how does that really affect what I'm bringing to the situation? Can I just let go and just see clearly what is right now? How are things right now, just as they are? Okay. Only the Zen masters know the gateway to the truth. And to me, what he's pointing at is only those who have a deep understanding of Zen, not just people who have the title of Zen master or have the kind of the thumbprint of being a Zen master, but anybody who deeply applies meditation to their life in that regard becomes the Zen master that he's talking about. Professors, well, some of them might actually be Zen masters too. It's the people who are just asserting that the Dharma is a certain kind of way of thinking of things that we can articulate and specify and write down and kind of codify and put out there. Okay. Those people who are clinging to an academic understanding. Okay, that's the end of that section. Any other kind of questions or thoughts about that?
The thing about cutting your arm off at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
I assume that even Dogen doesn't literally mean that.
No, well, I don't know what he meant, but no. It has become. There's a certain fad in Chinese Buddhism where monks would. Huineng, the disciple of Bodhidharma, who was said to have cut off his arm to show his sincerity. And that may have happened, really, but it's likely that he actually got his arm cut off in a fight earlier before that. Mm-hmm. He just happened to show up with only one and a half arms. And there's a line in the scripture, it might be the Avatamsaka scripture or the Lotus Sutra, about really being so dedicated to training that you burn up your body and mind with training. And it is viewed in our tradition that that is a metaphorical way of speaking. But in China, there is a kind of zealous tradition of monks and lay people burning off fingers and arms and all that stuff. The autobiography of Zhu Yun, a master called Empty Cloud, who was one of the greatest Zen masters in China in the 1950s, you know, up until 1950 or so, he passed away. He actually burned off one of his fingers in a kind of ceremonial kind of offering of merit to his mother. And, you know, he really did that. I just don't recommend it. Reverend Master Ji never recommended it. My teacher never recommended it. Or we were recommended against it. Because our idea is that really the kind of practice, the intensity of practice, comes from our will to harmonize body and mind. Okay. And these things are just sort of metaphorical. Yes.
Yes. Back to that part about presumption and choice that you just spoke of. I've understood about the presumption and how that can cloud our interaction with the present moment, but what, could you speak more about the choice
I think what he's talking about there is that there's the kind of multiplicity of things. There's all the different options out there where we can kind of get what we'd like. And to avoid choice in that sense is to just sit still and accept what is there, what is offered us, instead of kind of constantly going in an endless pursuit of the better thing. Okay. There is a kind of reality to choice. We constantly have choice. We can choose to sit still or we can choose to pursue things. And we often need to make choices between different courses of action. He's not saying don't make choices, because that is a reality in life. We need to make choices and do what we need to do to make commitments. So that is a real part of life. It's just that part of choice where you know, do I want the truffle with the blueberry in it, or do I want the truffle with the vanilla in it? You know, what am I going to do? What's the best thing? How can I get the most? How can I maximize my whatever I'm going to maximize from this? And in that sense, we don't have to kind of participate in that grasping after the best thing. If that makes sense. Does that make sense? Okay. And the whole kind of mind, which is really trying to maximize our external benefit, is part of, ties into a theme from earlier on in this work, where he was talking about impermanence. If we're constantly looking toward the external world, if we're constantly looking toward our options in the external world, we're never going to actually sit still enough to actually accept that it doesn't really matter what choice we make in an external sense about, you know, whatever it is, what color car I get. Just doesn't matter in an important sense, in that sense of the reality of our heart and mind. Okay. But we can kind of spend a lot of time spinning who we